This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right, let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. It is hour number three, and a good Monday to you. Golden State with a 107-88 victory in Game 2 last night. And you know what? I don't really want to get on legacy this early in a series, and I think we in the media business have a tendency to jump into that, I think, a little too quickly, where we want so badly to look at larger narratives. And I know my line always is I'm a big picture guy, but I think you have to be somewhat restrained in the big picture narrative when you're in a series like this. I mean, to talk about a legacy for Jason Tatum, a legacy for a continuing legacy for Steph Curry, I do think it's a little premature. Let this series play out to see what kind of narrative we might have for those particular superstars. But one thing you can't deny, and I think this was kind of something people expected going into the series, but it was absolutely brought back up again last night, is when you look at the longevity of this basketball team, and again, we've chronologically put this together for you before the finals even started. Their championship in 15, their loss in 16, their back-to-back wins in 17 and 18, the loss in the injury-plagued finals against Toronto in 19, and then how those injuries piled up and the loss of Kevin Durant allowed, you know, 15 wins in a season that was cut short from COVID, didn't get invited into the bubble, a team that barely made the play-in tournament in 2021, and now this team that is back in the finals. This longevity, though, that they've been on, which for the most part has been some of the top-level basketball you can play in the NBA, really stems from a couple of things, but the number one thing is the play of Steph Curry. And last night, 29 points in just 32 minutes. Think about that. He didn't even have to play in the fourth quarter. Just 32 minutes, he knocked down 5 threes, 9 field goals, 21 shots, 29 points. Even with Klay Thompson struggling and Draymond Green not, you know, he only scored 9 points but tried to contribute in other ways by being the aggravated defender on Boston stars. But Steph Curry is the straw that stirs this. And for him, to continue to show that on the largest stage possible, this is a guy that can still deliver some very exciting basketball. The way downtown threes that propelled a big run, all of those things really does make you wonder the long-term legacy of where Steph Curry is going if indeed he wins a championship. A little premature, but again, it's about Steph.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, again, join us on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. So I've been talking this morning about this game, too. And again, it's I'm going back and forth on this. I really don't find that both of these games have the thrill of an NBA final to them in terms of a real... You feel like the teams are equal. You really do. I mean, you feel like, yeah, the Boston plays great defense, and they've got guys who can score. Golden State plays good defense, and they obviously have guys who can score. They have got good role players. They're both well-coached. Kerr obviously has a lot more experience than Ime Udoka. The team, Golden State, has a lot more experience. Obviously, 132 finals appearance games combined on the Golden State Warriors compared to the zero for the Boston Celtics. But you kind of get a feeling like this is a series of two equally matched teams in terms of what they can do. But it's not been that way in the first two games, other than to say both teams flexed their muscles in one particular moment and both earned a victory in the first two games of the series. So if you're the Celtics, you go back to Boston and you've got your split. You may be a little bit wounded based on that third quarter, but you got your split. And if you're Golden State, that split is a little more than what you wanted, right? You obviously wanted to hold home court, go up 2-0, go to Boston, see if you can take one there, and kind of get the series done with in five games at the least, maybe six. But the reality of it is we might be in for the long haul. Now, I preface by saying that many series have been 1-1. We felt like we were going to have a long series. But then funny thing happened on the way to a game 7. We stopped in 5 games. You know, like I still, you know, still hold that one of these teams could win the pivotal game 4, right? The team that's up 2-1 could win the pivotal game 4, really put the other team on their heels and wrap this thing up. But as if I was a betting guy, I got to think that these first 2 games is giving me an indication that we might go pretty far into this postseason, into these finals. But I don't know how good the games are going to be in terms of quality, in terms of a back and forth late in the fourth quarter game tied. That doesn't mean they're not entertaining. One thing we talked about already this morning was in that run, that 11-0 run that sort of ignited this 35-14 third quarter that Golden State used to propel them to victory, it was rather entertaining to watch them do this. Now, if you're rooting for the Celtics, it wasn't entertaining because every three-pointer and long three-pointer was sort of a dagger in your hopes. But I think if you're just a casual basketball fan watching the finals, there was an element of entertainment to the way Golden State does its job and what they do best. And I think that was completely on display last night.
Question for you.
Yes.
Are the Celtics a three-point shooting team? Like, were they known this year to be deep ball players?
They've got some guys who can shoot three. They're because just not on Golden State's level.
It was during that third quarter, the one thing I noticed was it almost seemed like for best, definitely a stretch there. It was like a good 5-minute stretch. The Celtics were trying to match the Warriors and kept missing.
Yeah.
And the Warriors don't. I mean, they were. It didn't matter where they were taking it on the court. They were behind the arc. I didn't really see them like drive. I saw Draymond Green drive to the basket, and that was it. Everyone else is like, you're going to give us 30 yards? All right, we'll shoot it from back here.
Yeah,
30
it was.
Feet.
It was. I agree with you. That's the thing that was really amazing to me, right? Was I was impressed with like Golden State is back to being that really deep shooting basketball team. Like a lot of it was Steph, obviously. But Jordan Poole coming off the bench was fantastic.
He really was
fantastic. That's exactly what you want. That's exactly what you want from a guy that's coming off the bench, a guy that's going to give you the spark. He was the main reason that they went on that run. He was the main reason they did that was, you know, from that standpoint. I will say Boston's 3-point shooting. I mean, they attempt a lot. I mean, they're about a 35% shooting team, but I don't know. There's something about Golden State when they're on from that perimeter, they really can knock it down. It's just a weird, it's weird to see that disappear from Golden State's game when they can't make a shot from outside, because boy, when they do, they're really tough to beat. Klay Thompson, how many games does Boston expect Klay Thompson to be that dead?
Yeah.
Right. Like that, like struggling that much. Right. I think there is something to be said about the way maybe Golden State needs a little bit more of its role players to contribute, but they don't need to do that if Boston is going to struggle. But like I said earlier, I think a lot of people are undervaluing how good Golden State is defensively. And I think it's only because their opponent is way better than anybody else in the NBA at defense. And Boston is... It's their calling card, right? How good they are defensively. But Golden State's pretty good defensively, too. But I also think that the numbers of last night's game are a little skewed in a lot of ways, is that the game is getting away from Boston. They can feel it's getting away from Boston. And this is the way you start shooting from the perimeter. You start getting a little panicky in order to trim down the run, right? You're trying to get back in the game, and then you start missing, and then they start scoring. And before you know it, you're out. And I think that's what happened to them in the third quarter. Again, I'm not looking for every game in a 7-game series to be nip and tuck and right down to the wire coming down to the final seconds. I know games get away from good teams. I know that happens in series. That you can't expect all 7 games to be masterpieces in terms of its competitiveness. But it feels like this has just been a trend for Boston in these postseasons where outside of a handful of games on this journey to where they are right now, they have so many games in which either they or their opponent find a gap and find a period of time where they run away with the game. And like I said, for Boston, it was the fourth quarter in game one. Last night was the third quarter for Golden State. You can go through the Miami series. You can find exactly those kind of moments where the game got away from Boston and Miami did this in the third quarter. And then Boston did this in the second quarter. And then Miami did this in the fourth quarter. Like, you can find those moments in the series prior to it. I hope we get a long series because I think these two teams are worthy of that. I really do. I don't think Golden State is that much better than the Celtics. I really don't. I know it's easy because you feel like Clay, Steph, and Draymond are better than Tatum, Brown, and Smart. But I don't think that's really the case. I don't think that's the case. I think Boston, with those three guys and the defense that those guys play, it have no real fear of Golden State. No, they know they can win this series. They know that they can win these games. Last night was just ridiculous how on fire they were for that period of time, how Jordan Poole was really put the dagger in the game with that half-court three-pointer. But even by then, they were up by a ton. That was just an icing on an already built cake, how much of a lead that they had. So with all of that being said, I do not know what to expect Wednesday night, because I've got a Celtics team that has rebounded after losses so well in this postseason. Better than any team I've seen in a long time. They just win games after they lose. And the second thing is, I haven't seen a more uncomfortable team at home this deep in the playoffs in a long time either. The idea that one team in the NBA Finals is not a heavy favorite to win at home. I know they're a betting favorite because you always give the betting favorite. The home team should always be the betting favorite. But they're not comfortable at the Garden. They are not comfortable in this playoffs securing themselves at the Garden. Now, there's multiple things that are going on right now, which is, again, they respond well. They got a couple of days to figure all this out. They are playing at home. But I haven't trusted them at home all playoffs. Brooklyn could have got game one out of them in the opening series. Milwaukee got game five. I think I got game two? I mean, it's a real problem if you have a team this average at home during the postseason. Because that really means you got to win enough games on the road. And they're just getting harder and harder. It's one thing to go to Milwaukee. Well, Milwaukee's a fine place, a loud place. It's another thing to go to Miami. I'm telling you, that Golden State crowd, they know exactly how to fire that team up. But if you're Ime Udoka, you go, already got one. Let's see what we can do at home now. But so far, again, looking at this series through a lens of what exactly do we have, right? What we have is two teams that when they're on, when they find what works, have shown what they can do. Boston has shown what they can do in that fourth quarter, which is we can shut you down, we will knock down shots, we will get back in this game, and we will take over. Down 12 to win by 12. Golden State up by 20-something by the time we got into the fourth. It's those kind of transitions. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about Rafael Nadal winning the French Open and just the absolute excellence that has happened over the weekend for him at Roland Garros as we continue. It's Wake Up Call on SportsMap Radio.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the SportsMap Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, thanks for joining us as we continue on Wake Up Call. All right, so Rafael Nadal beat Casper Ruud or Rudd?
I believe it's Ruud.
Is it Ruud? R-U-U-D?
Yeah.
Beat him in straight sets Sunday morning to capture his 14th victory in the French Open and his 22nd Grand Slam overall. And Rafael Nadal won 6-3, 6-3, 6-0. I think that 6-0 was more like Ruud going, all right, that's enough.
Yeah, I'm done.
I tried. I'm not going to be able to win this thing.
It's also the second fewest games lost in a final.
Yeah.
Six.
So he was 19 years old when he first won in Paris, and he's going to be 36. He is 36. He just turned 36. And now has 22 Grand Slam titles. This guy is absolutely amazing. Amazing. And I don't know where to put him in terms of his victory on clay. I don't know how to compare it to any other athlete at any other particular sport.
See, I've been thinking about this too, and I honestly, the way I feel about it is that there is no comparison.
Yeah,
at this point, I can't think of. I mean, unless we change it up to something else.
You really don't have it in golf. Like not even Tiger won at Augusta this many times. Like there's nothing. It's more of an individual thing. So it's not like somebody at the Tour de France. I don't want to get into that rabbit hole, but I mean, it's just hard. It's hard to find an individual sport where you have one guy that is just this dominant on one particular surface. Like again, we were talking about him last week. He's better on clay than any other tennis player is on any other surface ever. It has to be. I can't think of the history of tennis. There's somebody who's won on a particular surface 14 times.
No, I mean, listen, I mean, I know Pete Sampras, I think he won 7 times at Wimbledon, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. And Roger Federer won 7 at Wimbledon or 8 at Wimbledon. And you know, they're great grass court players, but, I mean, this is double.
This guy has been winning this thing for pretty much every year since 2005. Like, think about 2005. It's crazy. That's an incredible run. Like from being a teenage player to an elder statesman of the sport. He just continues to go there and he continues to win. Look, we've seen dominant athletes, don't get me wrong. Of course we have. Absolutely. But is there anything like this where you just can't
I mean, I guess do we put
them?
Like what was the that Russian wrestler?
Oh,
you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, the guy that Rulon Gardner beat. Yeah. Maybe in a sport like that I don't know that much about. Maybe there is an archer who just dominates whatever or an Olympic sport I'm not as familiar with. But here's the other thing about Rafael Nadal. If he gets to a final at the French Open, he wins it. Like he's 14-0 now. So that means when he's playing for the championship, it's his. You're not getting it from him. Like you gotta beat him.
And that, you know, that probably hit Rude's head.
Yeah, right.
Sitting there in that third set, like, oh, I'm not coming back. Why even bother?
That's what I'm thinking. Like, if you're Rude, and again, you're 23, you probably think the world of yourself. You probably had people tell you how great you are. But do you think you go, I'm not going to be the first one that does this, and like that? That's going to be somebody else. It's not going to be me. I'm not going to be the one that is the one that beats him in the finals of this thing.
And that's why I wish someone just yelled out down to him and said, hey, University Maryland, Baltimore.
Yeah, right. Yeah, come. You can do it. You can do it. Yeah, exactly. It's really, really incredible. And I think you nailed it last week when we were talking about that match with Djokovic. It's just nobody's like him on this particular surface.
When you expand it beyond tennis, it's almost like one of those weird things. You have to stay within the realm of tennis.
Yeah, right.
And because there's no other sport like it, so you can't really compare. I mean, you can't sit there and go, well, Arnold Palmer won this many matches on this grass. You know, it's like,
yeah.
It's
right.
Not
it's
the
completely.
Same.
It's not the same. There's clay, there's grass, there's hard court.
Because I did the same thing to you. I immediately went Tiger at Augusta.
Right.
You know, but it's not.
It's not. It's not even close. From 2005 to 2022, he's lost 3 times. That's it. He's lost 3 times.
Yeah. And one
like,
of those times.
Tiger won the Masters in 2005, didn't win it again until 2019.
Yeah. But one of those 3 times for Rafa is that he withdrew. Yeah. He didn't get beat. He just, you know, injuries got the better of him and he couldn't do it.
By the way, the guy he was playing in the semifinals who had to leave for the ankle injury, that was a nasty, nasty ankle injury.
Yeah.
It makes you cringe. It makes me go, oh, I'm glad I'm not an athlete.
Well, that's that clay, man. I mean, that's one of my favorite things to watch about clay is, you know, seeing them run hard over there and then just kind of slide. And
that's the thing. That's the thing that always kind of makes me cringe. Not cringe, but like get a little nervous is like it's not. It's kind of slippery. It's like you have to be kind of careful what you're doing. You have to kind of know like what the limit is. Like, can I go all out, or if I go all out, am I gonna crash and burn?
Oh, I always feel like knees are gonna be torn.
Right, you know what I mean? Like, I gotta know. All right, I see that ball. Your brain has to, in a split second, calculate, do I have the speed on this surface to get there to get the ball? And if I do, what could be the end result? So you go, you may go after it. You may have to let it go because you just are like, I could get to that on any other surface, but I better be careful on clay. It's wild. I would love to know the strategic element of when guys are on clay, how they adjust for that surface. Because it does. Doesn't it look like it? There are sometimes where it looks like they're on ice. Like they'll slide right into a shot. Great stuff by Rafael Nadal.
Yeah, purposefully.
And yeah, not purposely. They know what they're doing. And they know exactly what they're doing. They know how to do it.
How about this? I mean, I know it's two people, but I know it was Misty May and Kerry Walsh on beach. But we don't know enough about it.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Like, we don't. They just always won the gold medal.
But have they always been around? Have they been winning all their things since 2005?
Well, not anymore.
Right, right. Well,
they don't do it anymore.
Right, but
that's the other thing too. They already checked out.
Have they done it consistently for how many years now? What is that? 16 years?
Yeah,
16, 17 years. It's crazy. You know, it's just I can't imagine. Like, we just don't. We don't see athletes, and I'm not trying to be hyperbolic here. We don't see athletes have that kind of success, consistent success at one thing for that long, right? We don't. Like, other than Tom Brady, that's it. But Tom Brady doesn't win the Super Bowl all the time. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, he's every time he goes to that tournament, he wins it. And in one time he withdrew, and two times he got beat by Djokovic.
Yeah. And even yesterday.
Before the finals.
Yesterday, after the match, he was talking. He was trying to explain. I mean, you know, he is from Spain, so his English is not the greatest. Or maybe his English is just fine, and he didn't want to fully divulge anything that any secrets that he was trying to keep and just, you know, blaming it on the language barrier. But he was talking about how he has foot pains.
Yeah.
And the doctor, he had his doctor there with him, and they said, yeah, I don't know what he did. He injected something, and it made, you know, basically what he said was my foot went to sleep.
Went to sleep.
So that way he wasn't feeling the pain. But he said
what?
That if he feels this way with Wimbledon's a priority for him, but if he feels this way with Wimbledon, he's not going to, he has no problems withdrawing.
Yeah, he's withdrawing. He has found his thing. Like he, like you said, like he does, Wimbledon's a priority, but again, he's not going to risk long-term situation. He'll just be like, I can't do it this year, but that's okay. Cause I got the thing I love. And that's Roland Garros in May/June.
They got a name of the main arena. I know what it's called. Rod Laver, right? Is
yes.
That the main,
I believe,
or
is
it Rod Laver somebody else?
No, that's a good question.
I don't know.
I got to look that up.
Whatever.
Now.
All I'm saying is whatever the main stadium is, because all the stadiums are always named. Whatever the main stadium is at Roland Garros, they need to change it.
Let's name it Rafael Nadal Court.
Yeah, I think you can change
it now. Rafael Nadal Arena.
Because he has owned that
whatever place. You want to call it. Stadium Nadal.
How would you say that in French?
Nadal de Stadium. I don't know. I told you, I learned that one line to get away with not being able to speak French. I mastered that one line. I don't even think mastered is a stretch. I'm probably not using the accent grave or accent aigu properly in the French language. But seriously, man, that's good stuff. Good stuff by Nadal. I'm telling you.
It's unfathomable.
It really is.
That's the thing. I mean, I you know, you and I, we spent the last 10 minutes just trying to find a comparison, and we can't.
Couldn't do it. And you know what the thing is? It's too bad. I think that most casual tennis fans in this country pay attention to Wimbledon. I don't think they pay attention to the French as much. The U.S. Open obviously gets a big boost because it's like late
but
August.
I'm going to argue that because I think with Nadal's success, we're starting to pay. I think
should
we've been
be.
Paying more attention we to the French Open.
Yeah, we should be paying a lot more attention. It's the one in Australia that's 4 days before this date on the calendar type of thing that we get confused.
Is that a weird day?
Is it a weird day?
Weird week.
All right. Tony D, Ron Culver, as we continue, it's Wake Up Call. Sportsmap Radio.
listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That is Ron with two N's. So, over the weekend in the mail, I got Seth Wickersham's book, It's Better to Be Feared, that I'm going to bring on my vacation to read. But I did tell my wife, and I think I told you last week too, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself. I did say I'm under no pressure to read this book. If I don't read a page of it on the cruise, I will not. I won't worry about it. I'll just be like, oh, I didn't get a chance to read the book. But if I'm at a position where everybody's kind of lounging around doing nothing, I'll break out the book. I did read the first chapter because I thought to myself, let me read the first chapter, and if this is good, if I'm intrigued by it, I'll bring it. And if I don't like the writing style, I'm not going to be enthusiastic about it. I kind of do this with books where I go, I just don't want to get caught in a book where five pages go by and I don't remember a thing. It just wasn't that good of a page turner. Happy to say it is a page turner. It's good. First chapter is just really good. It flows nice. He does a very good job writing it. But it was funny because in the prologue, and I thought this was kind of interesting. In the prologue, he's a writer for ESPN and he's covering the Patriots. And he's realizing kind of midway through the run, you know, this is something special, right? They've won three Super Bowls. They continue to win. But remember, they had a gap between Super Bowls. And he starts realizing, you know, wait a minute, this is going to be really good. And he starts predicting that there's going to be a book. But he makes an agreement with his literary agent that he cannot write the book until the relationship is broken up in whatever way it's broken up. Belichick retires, Brady retires, Brady leaves, whatever it is. But he's not going to publish a book about the relationship between Brady and Belichick until the relationship is done on a professional level. So he has to wait a number of years. But you know what benefits the reader on this? Is that he knows that he's writing a book, so he's looking at everything that occurs from that point that he realizes this is going to be a good book, but I got to wait till the story is over. Everything that happens, he goes through, he's now looking at it the lens of, well, I got to be a reporter for it, but I'm also gathering information for a future book. So we benefit from that he's got a lot of good details on some of the things that went on in the Patriots organization between the two. Really, really interesting.
That's actually really smart.
Really smart. Because a lot of times people don't know until they realize, oh, I want to do a book on that, and they have to kind of backtrack.
Well, yeah, and you're going back, and now you're trying to find the articles. Like, he's living in the moment. And like,
right.
It could be some nonsense, obsolete thing, too.
Yeah, and he's thinking to myself, well, I'm just going to put this in a folder. I'm going to write some notes down. I'm going to put it in a folder for a future book. Like Jeff Perlman. Jeff Perlman's a great author. But he goes back in time to cover things that have already been done, years have gone past, and then he's got to do the research. Like he wrote a book, Football for a Buck, on the USFL. And great, he's got great stories in there, don't get me wrong. But imagine if somebody at the time went, soon this thing will be over, it'll be historic, and down the road somebody will want to know the complete story of this. And then started really, really taking notes down for. Same thing with his Showtime book on the Lakers. Like, imagine if somebody at the time was like, when this is over 10 years from now, I want to write a book about the Showtime Lakers, and I'm gonna be around every day with those two lenses. That's what Seth Wickersham was. He was a guy that looked at everything and said, I got a report on this, I got a deadline, this Spygate thing, or this Deflategate thing, or this thing with Belichick, or this contract thing with Brady. But he's also going, and down the road, we're going to put this all together in a book. So I better start asking people about it. I better start getting quotes about it now, and get the, instead of people sort of having sort of a Monday morning quarterback memory, he's getting the memory, or he's at least getting the analysis at the time. Because a lot of times people, you know, you talk about something 10 years later, people have a tendency to sort of see it through a different lens than they are now.
And right? That's the other thing I was going to point out, too, because, I mean, it's his opinion.
Right, right, right.
You know,
right.
He fashioned the idea. You know, he's choosing, like, I think this is a bigger story than this. He might, and for us, we might have said, oh, no, this was the bigger story because that's what the public wanted. That's exactly what the public talked about.
But also, too, people have a tendency in memory to either overinflate or underinflate, but rarely get the right story, the right at the time what you felt, right? Like I can remember some, like my former boss in Colorado Springs. We're really close, really, really close to even to this day. But I remember being in his office. We had real knockdown, drag out debates about the way things were going. Now, if somebody were to ask me years later, oh, that time you guys were debating whether to do this or this, I might say, oh, we didn't talk to each other for 3 days. 3 days we avoided each other in the hallways. When that wasn't really true, but I might over-exaggerate it in my mind a bit. And that, and think about that on the football side of things, right? Like, hey, Belichick said this, Brady didn't like it. And then he could say, yeah, I was there around that time, and it really wasn't that big of a deal. But 10 years later, if somebody were to say, I'm going to go back and talk to all the old Patriots about what that relationship was like, that particular story, whatever it may be, might be over-exaggerated by the people who knew the story. And you're not getting the full, like, he at least is like, I've got boots on the ground. I've had boots on the ground for everything that went on in this dynasty. And I mean, I've fought, he was there from day one. He was there. He covered the team from the day Brady arrived. So he was there the whole time. And he gives you a good image of his prologue, gives you a good image of that final game against the Tennessee Titans in the playoffs and everything that was building up and all that. It looks like it's a good read. It looks like it's a good read. So I'm kind of excited about it.
So, yeah, but the big question that remains is, will it be something that you read on a cruise?
That's right. Will I actually read on? My wife actually said to me, I bet you don't finish half that book. She's not willing to go down the road of you won't read it. Because she's like, I could see you actually breaking it out a couple of times.
Oh, yeah. No, I have
but
no
she
doubt.
Goes, I bet when we get off that boat, wherever your bookmark is, it's not halfway through the book.
So I'm going to side on your wife with this one.
I think she
I have
right.
no doubt in my mind that you will read this book.
Yeah. It's because my brother is going on the cruise and my brother would walk by me and go, what are you doing?
Nerd.
Reading. What's wrong with you? There's alcohol to drink. There's a casino downstairs. Food. What's wrong with you? Reading a book. You don't even like the Patriots. Why are you reading that?
Some random Tuesday show.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's what it'll do. And I'll go, oh, okay.
I guess Come I can on. Put it down for a minute.
It's like, let's go downstairs and play some slots. All right. Let's go get some drinks. All right. Let's go eat for the fifth time today. It's not even noon. All right. Whatever, you know, whatever it may be. So, yeah, I think she's right. I don't even think I'll get halfway through it. So then I got to read it this summer. Then I'll figure it out. But, yeah, it looks like a pretty good read.
So. I think it'll be one of those things like you're laying in bed and you're just like, I'm still a little bit awake. And yeah. Just maybe knock off a chapter or two.
Is there a time period? And I know we've gotten a lot of different books. But is there a time period in sports that you wish – somebody on the scene wrote about the minute it was over and said, I was there from day one. I got it all. Like
I think it would be early baseball.
Early baseball?
Not so early. You know, I'm talking like the 20s and 30s, back when it was like the gentleman's game. It
sure.
was, you know, people went to, because I'm fascinated in the sense of how good was the game then?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Because
I see
always,
a lot of numbers and I go, do they really do?
Like, right. You know, did this guy, I mean, for me, I feel like every single pitcher went 9 innings.
Right. And Cy Young won 511 games.
Yeah, it's in like, one season, it feels like.
Right? You're like, that's a lot. But, you know, he pitched shorter rest, was able to go long. Like, you know, obviously the modern game has changed, but you're right. To me, this is going to sound weird because it's a little bit more modern. To me... And there might be a book out there, I just didn't see it, like that happened immediately. I would love to read a book about the Leitner years at Duke. The Leitner Hurley years at Duke. When that was all said and done. I think that was a basketball team that was hated, loved, respected, adored. I mean, there was a lot of different ways people looked at that team. A lot of it comes from the I Hate Christian Leitner documentary, but I would have loved to have really, really gotten to the nitty gritty of what that team was dealing with, because they were the Beatles. They were the Rolling Stones. I mean, they really were they were unlike, at the time, they were like unlike any team that we had. I mean, they needed separate entrances and exits to hotels. And they were rock stars without the universal admiration.
So are you trying to tell me that they were the Tom Brady's going to Munich?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And what is it like for a college kid to be despised yet somewhat adored?
Not only that.
Around the country?
Not only that, but I want to know what the day-to-day was. Because yeah. I remember I had a biology class that was with most of our school's softball team.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just always an interesting dynamic.
Because
sometimes they were there, sometimes they weren't.
Right, right.
Sometimes, you know, I mean, they always were, like, sitting next to each other. And, you know, and I got included into that grouping. And maybe I would have been interested in, like, knowing, like, just firsthand accounts, like, you know, Bobby Hurley was this type of student.
Right. That little things like that. I would have loved to have sort of known, just because it was in a pre-internet era. So they still felt the hate. It's one thing to see athletes now. They know it. They go on Twitter.
Yeah.
They know it, right? But in the 80s and 90s, you had to feel it from the crowd. You had to feel it from, he made some comments that had people thinking he was gay, right? And there were some really homophobic chants that were directed at him. And he played off of that, and he said, I don't care what they think. I don't care what they think. I truly, like, that's an interesting, for a young man, for a young person, he literally did not care. Like, he really didn't care. The scrutiny that came with it. He knew who his people were. He knew the people that cared about him more than anybody else. He knew when people were coming after him for what he was. And that played into the whole team aspect of it. So to me, that's my team. That's the team I would have liked to have seen a book come right out afterwards that said, I was there from day one, and I'm telling you, these are the stories of that particular basketball
team. Yeah, I also would have loved to know what teachers thought.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Right. I mean, these guys were on the covers of every magazine, like not just sports magazines, every magazine. Yeah.
And did they still get full credit for turning a paper in late right, because they were playing North Carolina the night before and
right,
teacher
exactly.
was at that game?
And what if you had Grant Hill in your class and he stubbed in and, like, we can't even get started. everybody's surrounding him and momming him, and we can't even get a lesson in him. All right, we'll come back, wrap up the show as Sports Map Radio.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right. Thanks for joining us on Sportsman Radio. I'm going to close by saying today is the remembrance of D-Day on the beaches of Normandy, June 6th. You know, I always go back on this date to Saving Private Ryan. I always go back to that movie because I think that was one of the more incredible experiences I had in a movie theater. Watching that scene when the young men were getting off the boat and were on the boat on their way to the beaches and what they experienced. It's a level of bravery I don't think I could generate myself. Does that make sense?
Totally. 100%.
Like, you know what I mean? Like you don't know until you're there, right? We all don't really know what would happen. We all think we would act a certain way. And then when stress and the moment comes, maybe we would act differently. Maybe we would rise to the challenge, rise to the occasion, knowing that our lives were on the line. Maybe that's the case. But every time I watch that opening scene of Saving Private Ryan, I go, I don't know how I would have done that.
I couldn't.
I don't know how I, especially being on the first boats.
First wave.
The first wave. Oof. That the commanders knew were going to get wiped out, and knowing as soon as this,
and
soon
okay
as I,
with it,
yeah, and being and just that moment where they're just on the boat going to the beach, knowing like what they were going to face, and then just the chaos. And I go, I know it's a movie, I get it, but it's the closest I can get to knowing and just sort of having that sort of feeling of the respect I have for every single person that either lived through that or died through it. It's all I have. So I know it's a it's a little weird, but it's the thing. Every time I see that, I go, God, I just, the amount. We always talk about the people that sacrificed in a way that's sort of just broad, you know, but then you see the nitty gritty details and you think to yourself, I don't know if I could have gone. I don't know what I would have done. Would I have found the nearest thing to hide behind, or would I actually charge? Would I actually try to take that beach? I don't know. And the amount of respect that I have for the people that did have to make that decision at a young age, that knew the consequences and went anyway and did it anyway and knew what they were facing, remarkable. So that's the remembrance of this day, of remembering D-Day on this day, June 6th. But yeah, it's Steven Spielberg has done some good stuff with the films in terms of bringing out emotion of some real events. But what was the, forgive me for not remembering after that movie, besides that scene, what was the purpose again? Matt Damon's character was the lone survivor of a family that got, his three brothers got killed.
Yeah, there was four boys, three of them had all died.
Like, and they went to go get him to bring him home.
Yeah, they didn't want the mom to bury all four of her boys.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, I remember. So, all right, we'll be back tomorrow as we get even more closer and closer to Game 3 of the NBA Finals. Stick here, right here on Sports Map Radio. Tony D, Ron Culver, we will see you tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your Monday.